Hey friends, I'm Naomi, and I'm glad to have you here listening to A Creative Purpose. This space is here to encourage and support creatives bring their ideas to life. I believe we each have our own brilliance to share with the world, and when we lean into that, we have opportunities to live an adventurous life. I have some great conversations with other creatives where they share their journey and the lessons learned along the way. I'll also share my story and what I've learned and am learning on this beautiful, sometimes difficult road to living a life I love. Welcome back, friends, to another episode of A Creative Purpose. And I am so excited to have Jack here today, also known as the Accidental Journalist. I'm excited to hear what his journey has been like and the lessons learned along the way. So, Jack, can you tell us where you're from and what you do?
So I am based in Norfolk in England, although I come from a small town in West Yorkshire in the rural north of England. I'm a writer, a creative, a poet, actor, consultant, journalist, whatever people want to call me, really. I found sobriety through, among other things, creativity. So you know, that's why I found myself on here, really. I love to talk about creativity and the role that it's had in my recovery and my journey as a journalist, as a parent, as a man in my community, as a member of my church. So it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try and keep it as basic as I can. So I grew up, like I say, in the rural north of England, where it was all mines. In 1984, there was miners' strikes because our prime minister shut down a load of the mines. So there was we went from an affluent area to an impoverished area pretty much overnight. So I was brought up the child of a railway man, a civil engineer, and a social worker. I was brought up in a nice house in a nice neighbourhood with loving parents. But I was dyslexic, and there was no such thing, really. There's no word for dyslexia where I was from and when I was growing up. So I was seen as a bit thick, a bit special, a bit, you know. I always had a good head for words. I was always good with words. I was always good at mimicking people, impressions. I would look at walls. I would look at the sky, and, you know, most people would see, you know, walls and sky, but I would see something that I wanted to put words on, and I couldn't do it because I couldn't read or write. I just knew, what these words sounded like, and I knew what they felt like and how they made me feel inside. But I grew up in a town where I guess you would call it roughnecks. So, you know, I was seen as a bit weak and a bit, you know, got called gay a lot, though I'm not. So, yeah. And then on my 8th birthday, after a really nice day of pop and cakes and things like that, I remember sitting on my mum's knee. I loved my mum to bits, and, you know, I remember vividly she had this sort of look of pain. I'll never forget that pain that I saw in her eyes. That was the first time I saw pain in someone's eyes. And my dad was sitting, you know, I can't even tell you what they were wearing, but my dad was sitting with his newspaper and his peeking over his glasses as my mum then proceeded to tell me that she loved me very much, and my dad loved me very much, and my sister loved me very much, but I wasn't theirs, that I was adopted, and that I had a mum who loved me but couldn't take care of me. So for most people without a divergent brain, they would think, well, at least somebody loves me. But that for me was a catalyst to all my bad behavior. Imagine being 8 years old and having an existential crisis, well, that's what it was like for me. That's when the lights went out. I was put at 12, 13 into the special school system. I somehow managed to get through middle school and 1 year of high school without, being picked up as too much special needs. But they then sent me into the special school system. But by then, I learned to, the way that I used to cope with how I felt was I would lie. I would lie about who I was, where I'd been. Some of these were outlandish, you know. I remember vaguely a teacher asked me where we were going on holiday, and I'd seen The Simpsons the night before, and it was an episode of where Seymour Skinner had served in Da Nang. So I said Da Nang, and that put me in front of everybody to ridicule, and I became a point of ridicule by the teachers and the other kids. But then they, because I became a liar, because that was how I dealt with it, they, they began to abuse me mentally and sexually. I was passed around from teacher to teacher to social worker. And I was told that nobody would ever believe me because I was nothing but a liar. So that kind of fueled my bad behavior. By the time I was 13, 14, I was drinking behind the school shed, 3 liter bottles of what was called White Lightning, strong white cider, smoking joints, doing coke, stuff like that. The school I went to, it was a mile anywhere. In any direction to pretty much anywhere. So I was gifted at one thing and one thing only, really, and that was running. I was in the cross-country team. I was school and county level. I could do a mile in about 8 minutes. So I learned that I could run drugs, pirated VHS tapes, cassette tapes. Some of the first pirated CDs, I believe it was one of the first ones was Fat of the Land by The Prodigy, Porn, everything. I was running it and I was making a load of money. Plus I was doing a milk round and a paper round, and I was working in a key cutting shop on a weekend in the morning, and a plastering shop in the afternoon. So I always had money, and then pocket money I got from my mum and dad and stuff. But I still had this void. I had these words that I would speak, and you know, my dad would call me airy fairy because I had a certain way of speaking. And believe it or not, I speak quite well for someone from where I'm from. I'm quite posh compared to a lot of other people. But I always had an affinity for words. I always loved words. I loved to sing, to mimic people and things. And that carried on for a long time. I got beaten up at school quite a lot. And I learned that actually I'm probably stronger than I thought, because I could take a beating, which is another impoverished place. It's another market town that, you know, but it was one of the main collieries, one of the main mines that was shut down. So there was a lot of difficulty there, a lot of poverty. And I just did a lot of drugs and pretended to be other people for a long time. I got involved with a firm out in a place called Leeds, one of our main cities. I did some bare-knuckle fighting. I did some debt collection with a guy by the name of Paul Sykes, who was a famous boxer. Could have fought Muhammad Ali, but he liked his special brew too much. He drank too much, ruined his career. He wrote a beautiful book called Sweet Agony while he was in prison. And I just spent my life just going to and from thing in 1999. I lost my best friend. My best friend died in a car accident, and he was the first one to ever get me sober. He was a big 6'4" bloke that was about 24, 25 stone, built like an absolute beast, but gentle as anything. He loved my poetry, so he would take me to these open mic nights where he would get me to recite the poetry. And I got to do it with some of the British greats, you know, including a guy by the name of Karl Marx over here and Carl Dallas. And yeah, it was just, it was all right. And then I had a friend throw himself, best friend throw himself in front of a train after an almighty bender, because he was gay and he couldn't tell his parents. My mental illness was getting worse. I tried killing myself a few times. And then I went to live with a friend down in a place called Portsmouth at the other end of the country, bottom of the country. Got into rehab, got sober after a little stay in in incarceration. And then I started to get sober. I got proper sober in 2001, early 2001, and started what's called the Prince's Trust, which is a thing for young people where they can go and they can learn creativity and things like that. I'd learned to read and write in prison, so you know, I was getting myself back on track. And I started the Prince's Trust, Prince of Wales Trust, and as part of that, I learned how to do sound engineering at a local club, and I did some magic and tabletop magic and stuff. Met myself a bit of money at the weekends, and then I met my now ex wife, and then I moved to the city where I am, near where I am now, which is, our closest city is Norwich. And I had a few years, I had 12 years clean and sober, and I got into writing, and I wrote a film that was going to be made by some big names here, kind of based on my life and some of the drug running that I did and stuff like that. But I got caught into it, and I got caught into that lifestyle. I ended up drinking again and back on the gear. My marriage ended. I ended up in hospital a few times. I ended up homeless. Couldn't keep a place down. I kept spending my money on drugs. And I had a few years where I was just using churches for what I could get, and the kindness of other people. At the weekends, I was allowed to sleep at a friend's house on the sofa so I could have a relationship with my daughter, which I maintained all the way through. I got very, very ill. I went through cancer 3 times while I was homeless. Got better 3 times, but I went through cancer 3 times. And then I just went into an almighty breakdown. And I guess it was February, March 2014. I was in a food bank, a coffee morning, and I was there, and there was a woman with a young baby who was only about just over a month and a half old, 2 months old. And we got talking, and you know, we really got on. I was still on the gear at the time, still homeless, but on and off staying in people's houses and stuff. I'd been staying with a guy, but he was quite dangerous for me because his thirst for drugs was quite up there with mine. So we didn't do each other any favors. But she, you know, her name was Joanna, and she took pity on me, and she took me out for a meal, and she bought me electric for my friend so I could at least have a room for a week or so. And she bought me food, and she just treated me really nicely, despite being told that I was bad news. I was known in my city as quite a bad person. And then we got talking. I lost my uncle and my aunt quite closely in Yorkshire. So I was up and down to Yorkshire a lot. And we were talking over Facebook. And then I knew that I wanted to try and make a go of things. So I remember sitting in a crack house in a middle floor flat in a high-rise block of flats in the centre of Norwich. And it's the 26th of June 2014, 10 o'clock at night. I'm sat there with an almighty bowl of crack cocaine. I don't know if you know anything about it, but the last thing you want to do when you smoke it is go to sleep. And I'm sat there and I say, you know, I can't do this anymore, God. I don't even know if you exist anymore, but if you do, either take my life or take away this thirst, this hunger for drugs and drink. And I fell asleep and I woke up at about 4 minutes past 12 on the 27th of June, 2014, and I haven't used a day since. It was taken away from me there and then. You know, I've had a few using dreams, and you know, but apart from that, I haven't even thought about it. I was miraculously healed of that. Started to build my life back up, moved in with Jo, who's now my wife. We got married in 2019. Things were great up until February 2015 when I started getting ill. March the 9th, 2015, I became so ill that I ended up in hospital. I was in A&E at 20 past four. By half past seven, I was dead. Tuberculosis, two acute double lung failure, pleurisy, some environmental disease that we haven't seen since 1948 or something like that. Because of the life that I'd lived before, I'm quite a strong person. My body's quite used to being in different types of stresses. So I just kept pushing it off and taking paracetamol and prayer. But I died at half past seven at night. I was dead and I went to hell. And it was I felt like I was being forced to listen to my, not watch, but listen to my life, listen to the people within my life around me while I was being watched with CCTV cameras. They did bring me around and they had me on some pretty strong drugs that were hallucinogenic as well. So I became convinced I caused the apocalypse and that I was being punished. And my room was right next to a helicopter pad. So I would intermittently hear this helicopter coming, and I thought they were bringing people in from my life and holding what's called a kangaroo court outside the door. I went mute. And when I wasn't mute, I was screaming and attacking nurses and the lead pastor from my church, the lead minister from my church came and to pray for my soul because they thought they were going to lose me again. I wouldn't eat. I was 6 stone 6 ounces, which is probably less than 80 pounds. Not a small guy. I'm 6'1" myself. I lost 50% of my muscle mass. I had to learn to eat again, to walk again. But there was this guy that was hanging out at the end of my bed, and he was really getting on my nerves because I couldn't see him, but I knew he was there. He was just, there was a kind of peace about him, but it was kind of unnerving and I hated it. And in between that, there was this young Asian doctor that would come in, a female Asian doctor. And the rules of our NHS is that you're allowed to wear a cross, but you're not allowed to show it, or you're allowed to wear something that shows your faith inside of your clothes, but not show it to the public. You know, I was blown away when I was talking to someone from the States saying, you know, from the deep south a few weeks ago, when they were saying that their doctors regularly pray with them. That's not allowed here. That's illegal. But she would, when she was in there alone, she would allow it to hang down because I would be transfixed on this cross. And then when somebody would come in, she'd just put it away. But I had this sense of this person at the end of my bed, just kind of out of my periphery. And that went on for weird, about 2.5 weeks, I think it was. I was in hell for what I believe to be about 4.5 minutes, but it felt like weeks, months. And then I just instantly knew who this person was at the end of my bed. And I'm like, all right, okay, I know it's you, Jesus. What have I got to do? And I just heard this voice saying, you know what, I got to do. So I went, all right, then. I accept it. I accept you. And it was like a filter came away from my eyes. All the darkness then turned to light. It was kind of like sometimes when you first turn a television, an old television on, the old CRT televisions, and it would take its time to kind of brighten up. You know, the picture would be kind of blurry and then it would come in into focus. That's kind of how it felt. I'd had this really bad rash from my under my chin to just below my waist that was caused by as an adverse reaction to one of the drugs that I was given. It really felt like I was being burned by acid. And the nurse came in and she looked at me and she said, what's going on? And I went, can I get washed, please? Bearing in mind, I hadn't spoken for weeks. The doctors came in and they started checking me and they were like, wow. I said, can I have a wash, please? I feel really dirty. You know, my beard was out of control. My hair was out of control. And they brought this big bowl of water in and I sat there washing myself. And literally, I got the sponge and I started washing here and this rash just started to peel away and disappear as a doctor stood at the end of my bed, just, what's happening? And it just miraculously just peeled away and went as I washed it away. People started coming and visit me. They were so happy that I was eating. They were bringing me sweets and tins of Spam into my hospital room. You've never smelled anything as glorious as a hospital ward smelling a Spam because the nurses are cooking it for you. While I was in hospital, I got made redundant and I got some redundancy money. So I decided that I was going to try and put some weight back on because they told me if I hit 8 stone, I could leave and that I would be out in time for my stepson's birthday. I was having my breakfast on the morning and then an hour later I was going down and buying another breakfast and then I was eating sweets and chocolate up until dinner time, having their dinner. An hour later I was going down and having another dinner. Eat all the way, you know, they'd be cooking Spam for me and I'd be eating sweets and then you know, tea time, I'd have tea and then about 7 o'clock at night I'd order a 2-for-1 pizza from a local kebab shop. They would deliver it pretty much to the ward and I would have one, a 12-inch pizza, and the nurses would share another. And within 2 weeks, I went from 6 stone 6 to 8 stone 3. And I was allowed to leave and I started to rebuild my life back. And I started, you know, going to church. I gave my life to God. I decided I was going to get baptized. And there was four of us baptized on the same day. This, our church was run from a school hall on a Sunday. And my wife came with me and, you know, the baby and a couple of the kids. And I went in there and my wife just, her jaw dropped. And she said, that's your consultant from the hospital. What? She said, that's your consultant from the hospital. And I went up to speak to him and he was like, it's so good to see you looking really well. I was on 2 walking sticks at the time, but he says, you're looking a lot better than you were when, you know, when I was treating you. And I'm like, well, why are you here? And his son was getting baptized on the same day as me. And yeah, I became an active member of the church. I started doing Alpha courses and then our school, our church, we're very blessed to have a guy by the name of Grantley Watkins, who is a church builder, is a church planter. And, you know, he was converted by Billy Graham, you know, back in the day. So, you know, he's a very, very strong man. And he started this school of supernatural life where we learn how to live like Jesus lived and learn how to live in the miracles. And so I started that school the second year it was running, and I'm about to start teaching on the school in September. And some of the things that we do, people bring prophecy, and people kept bringing the same prophecy saying that you're going to bring God into the entertainment industry. I'd given up on film. It had driven me mad. And then I got a phone call asking me if I want to go out and speak to a a director because they want to speak to somebody who's had a life like mine. So I went out. It was in an old airfield in rural Norfolk. It's a lady called Joanna Hogg for a film called The Souvenir that was funded by Martin Scorsese. And I was asked to play Ray, just a small character, but I was also asked to advise on the film, which I did, and I advised on the second film. I thought I was going to get back into acting again and start doing a bit of consulting. I played one of your serial killers, John Eric Armstrong, baby doll killer for Twisted Killers. But then COVID hit and lockdown hit. I really struggled with the first one. So the second one, I was speaking to a friend who was a hostage negotiator, of all things. And he said, why don't you start a podcast and why don't you start writing again? I'd written my two books. I'd spent 6 months working with escapees of human trafficking. I'd written a book about it. I'd written my first book about my life and the poetry and things like that. I was looking for other things to do. I got involved with a book about a guy by the name of Paul Massey, who was seen as a gangland boss in a place called Manchester. And then I lost my mum to my biological mum, who I had a relationship with. I lost her to cancer in 2017, the Easter 2017, April. And then in June, my sister had a baby Luna. And at 2 days old, her father beat her to death, or beat her to within an inch of her life, and she passed away about 4 or 5 days later in hospital. He got life with a minimum of 10 years. He was 23 when he went in, so he could have been out by the time he was 33. And I hated him and I wanted to kill him. And I went through all these things and, you know, I was torn as a Christian man and I had this thing about vengeance and hate. And in the October 2017, he was murdered by his cellmate, and it wasn't out of anything that, oh, you murdered a baby, so we're going to murder you. It was for a £20 debt for spice, which is a drug that is used in prisons over here. We had to wait nearly a year for the funeral. One of the leaders of the church took me to the funeral because I couldn't do it on my own. And I remember being sat there and the pink coffin there, baby, because it was so small. I went out. This was within the days that I smoked, and after the service, I went out, and the first thing I did was light a cigarette. As I turned round, Liam's mum just put her arms around me to say thanks for coming, and I broke. I absolutely broke. And I was taken to my friend's car, and I sat in there. And I can only describe it as I don't know if you've ever been angry and then really hurt yourself so badly that that anger has just dispersed and gone and you've got a kind of clarity. It's when your body kicks in, just kind of stop the shock. You get like a sudden clarity. Well, that's the only thing I can describe it. This sudden clarity that you can only get when you break a bone in anger just came over me, and I just started to weep. And Chris said to me, what's going on? I'm like, I've got to forgive him, Anna. He's like, what? You know, this guy's a preacher by trade. And he's like, what? I said, I've got to forgive him, Anna. I knew that I had to forgive him. I knew that I had to forgive his mom and his family. And not because I was advocating what he did was right, and not because I then suddenly liked him. You know, I decided that I needed to love him in a Christian way, to wish the best for his family, to love him enough not to let him get on my mind. Forgiveness does not mean forget. And it's been a journey over this past few years, learning to forgive my captors as a child, learning to forgive everything. There are days when it affects me and there are days when it gets better. But I forgave him, and I decided that I needed that for my own mental health. And I started doing these. I started talking to other people, but I started my own podcast, Live and Undrugged, originally started as ShedX. I'd got turned down for a TEDx talk, and my friend had got turned down for a TEDx talk at the Negotiator. And so we decided to do it together. And we'd called it ShedX, and I did about 7 or 8 on the ShedX. And then from the October, and then in the January, it got changed to Alive and Undrugged. And I did 35 in the first season, and I'm up to about 18, 19 now in this season. And I've spoken to lots of creatives. I've spoken to people that were, that have been, you know, a guy that spent 13 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, a guy that spent 14 years in prison for a minimal crime that he was only sentenced to 6 months, but under the sentence that he was sentenced under, he ended up serving 14 years on a barbaric sentence. I've spoken to people, convicted terrorists, convicted murderers, convicted killers. I've spoken to campaigners and of forced marriage. I've spoken to former undercover police officers, actors, writers, former addicts like myself. I've laughed with people, I've cried with people, and I've learned to know who I am. I've put a lot of creativity and my creativity into doing the podcasts, and you know, it's now coming to the point where I'm looking at going up the next level and I'm creating different content for other things, and I'm going to be starting another book at the end of the month. I've got a 2-year waiting list of people that want to write books for them. Not bad for a dyslexic crackhead from Yorkshire, really. And yeah, so I guess that's where I am today. Kind of jack of all trades, master of none, but hence the name. Yeah, I love it. Creativity has been a staple in my life since I can ever remember. It's helped me overcome shyness and lack of self-confidence. I never thought I would have the confidence to share my story fully and truthfully with people like you all over the world. Yeah, I do, almost on a daily basis. Creativity has been my savior at times. I've written and produced 2 award selected festival selected films, short films. And yeah, I'm just going from really strength to strength as a partner, as a father, as an artist. I'm a photographer as well. Yeah, so here I am, yeah. I guess.
Thanks. Thanks so much for sharing all that. And if people wanted to see your work and get connected to you, because it sounds like you have a lot of good stuff going on, where can they do that?
So they can do it through, if you're on Facebook, you can do it through facebook.com/JW Greg. If you're not on Facebook, you can find me on jwgreg.wordpress.com. Everything about me is on there. All my interviews are on the front that I've done like this are on the front page. My series is under the Live and Undrugged tab. There's links to pretty much everything, the films that I've done, the my podcasts are also audio as well, so I also share the audio. There's a few blogs on there. That is mainly where you can find me. I am on YouTube under The Accidental Journalist, but you can access that through The Accidental Journalist page on the webpage. I'm on pretty much every social media under, I think on Twitter, it's at 2geeks1b. My Insta is j_w_greg, and I think I'm jwgreg on TikTok as well.
Nice. So you're everywhere, so we can find you. Okay, and I'll put all that in the show notes so people can link to it to get to you. But thank you so much again for sharing your story, and it's a story of hope and persistence, the way I see it, of just never giving up and learning along the way to just continue to come into yourself and really find who you are and who you were created to be, and that you can always come back from any setbacks that life is gonna, you know, throw at you. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm learning that. I'm 45 years old and I'm finally learning who I am. You know, I call myself a hooligan, WH hooligan, because I never knew who I was. You know, existential crisis at 8, and I'm 45 and I'm still discovering who I am. It's a journey and it's a fight. It's not always easy. You know, it's constant me having to hand my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him on a daily basis. And I get through and I love it. I love life now. I have a great life, a family, I've shed, you know, I have a community that love me and that I love. So, you know, what I would say to anybody that is fighting out there, keep on fighting. There is an end, you know, there is always an end. Sometimes it takes a big slap in the face like it happened to me. And sometimes it's more subtle, but there is an end. There is a way out. And if anybody wants to know anything else, just contact me through the website. I'll quite happily speak to you and point you on to the right people.
Awesome. Thanks. And I think that's one of society's lies, that we have to have ourselves figured out by a certain age. So, because if we're continuing to grow and learn and expand, we're always discovering a new us. And so thanks for leaning into that journey and seeing where it takes you. So thanks again for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
I can't thank you enough for listening to these podcast episodes and supporting the work that I'm doing here. If you can think of anybody that could benefit from the conversation I just had, please go ahead and forward that to them. If you are on Apple Podcasts, a review would be much appreciated, or a follow on Spotify is how I can continue to get the word out about the work that I'm doing here. If you would like more support and encouragement throughout your week, you can find me on Instagram at A Creative Purpose. And I would also like to drop into your email box with some more insights and encouragement throughout your weeks. And you can do that at naomigeidel.com. Until next time, go serve the world as only you can.